This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
I'm Ainsley Earhart.
I'm Brett Baer.
I'm Katie Pavlich, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Thursday, March 23rd, 2023. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. The banking system is sound, according to the Federal Reserve Chairman, but the recent banking crisis loomed large over the Fed's rate hike decision, even though elevated inflation still runs the show for now.
If banks can't compete with money markets, then, you know, that means there could be a bank run. So they're in a delicate position, but to a degree, aggressive rate hikes by Jay Powell helped put them there.
I'm Dave Anthony. Could TikTok be banned? Should it? There's a hearing on that in Congress today.
When you're on your TikTok, just understand that your children are sending all of their data right back to the Chinese Communist Party. So that makes this particular app, although there are many like it, quite risky.
And I'm Charlie Hurt. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
With all the scary news out of the banking sector, the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank and First Republic being bailed out by other banks, the pressure was on the Federal Reserve. Would they raise rates or not this week, and by how much? Well, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell announced a quarter point hike, bringing the federal funds rate to 5%, signaling that persistent inflation outweighed concerns with the banks for now.
The Fed's monetary policy actions are guided by our mandate to promote maximum employment and stable prices for the American people. We are highly attentive to the risks that high inflation poses to both sides of our mandate, and we are strongly committed to returning inflation to our 2% objective.
Powell added, though, notably, that issues with banks right now do factor into their decision-making and will in the future, that before the banking problems, they were planning on more rate hikes through the year, but now Powell says the effects of the last couple of weeks will tighten financial conditions on their own to some extent.
In principle, as a matter of fact, you can think of it as being the equivalent of a rate hike or perhaps more than that. Of course, it's not possible to make that assessment today with any precision whatsoever. So our decision was to move ahead with a 25 basis point hike and to change our guidance, as I mentioned, from ongoing hikes to some additional hikes, maybe some policy firming may be appropriate.
But he said the U.S. banking system is sound, that while some banks have experienced liquidity issues, the Federal Reserve Board, with the support of Treasury, created the Bank Term Funding Program to ensure banks can borrow reserves against assets they're holding. This, combined with their discount window, he said, is meeting the unusual funding needs some banks face.
Everyone involved in the bailout of Silicon Valley, the billionaires of Silicon Valley, not Silicon Valley Bank, where shareholders and bondholders were allowed to go, to go bankrupt.
Charles Payne is the host of Making Money on Fox Business.
But the billionaires who banked there, 93% of their deposits were over $250,000. Everyone involved in that decision has been really working overtime in this public relations aspect. And I think what gets them in trouble, and maybe even Powell, is when they keep talking about how strong and resilient the banking system is. And what we've actually seen in the last week is, so the Federal Reserve has all of these sort of tools, mechanisms. They create things out of whole cloth overnight. There's a thing called the discount window where you go, for banks to get money. That saw a record amount of money in one day. There's a Federal Home Loan Bank, which is a Depression-era bank. It was created during the Great Depression to help small and mid-sized community banks. That saw even more money drawn from it. They created a new facility, so banks holding assets like mortgage-backed securities or bonds that may be worth a dollar, let's say 3 years from now, but currently are worth 70 cents, can go to the Fed and get a dollar right now. So there's been some serious emergency actions. Their balance sheet swelled by $300 billion in a single week. So it's fine if you say these are cautionary measures, but there's certainly some angst to them. And so... Yeah, it's clear that if there are some more bank emergencies, that it's going to have an impact. Because one other thing that he did acknowledge, while saying their hands aren't tied with respect to hiking rates in the future, They admit that they're at a point now where there's a likelihood, and I'm trying to paraphrase here, a likelihood that credit tightening is going to start to even speed up even more in the economy. It's going to hurt overall demand.
Charles, it's such an interesting point, right? Because Powell was essentially saying that the credit tightening that we may see will function as a sort of right. mini rate hike. But I wanted to ask you to, you know, to your broader point about the bank sort of relying on outside federal sources for liquidity. With these banking issues, days before Silicon Valley collapsed, the FDIC chair said, as you know, that the value of U.S. banks' long-term assets dropped like over $600 billion last year. And now there's this new Stanford analysis that says the banking industry's unrealized losses are possibly more than three times that. Meaning that many more banks may be exposed, much the way Silicon Valley was, which is obviously sort of terrifying. How exposed do we suppose other banks may be, and when do we worry? Because we're already seeing like PacWest is having issues now, that right, they're the latest bank.
That's a great question, because the Wall Street Journal, in response to a question from the Journal, Powell tried to pivot to this, and he said, and I'm paraphrasing, right, he said something to the effect that everyone could see what the Fed had been doing with, you know, their Fed tightening policy. They started these rate hikes, 75 basis points, 75 basis points, 75 basis points. And so he said that it was well telegraphed and that most banks were prepared. In other words, again, alluding to the fact that maybe some poorly run banks like Silicon Valley Bank sat on their hands. But to your point, the FDIC, December 1st, going over just what had happened to the first three quarters of last year, $670 billion unrealized gains. And what I think the most eye-popping thing about that is at the time it was up 47% just in the past 3 months. So just in that, you know, just during that summer period, we saw that kind of explosion of unrealized losses. You know, one of the big problems, and it's not in the stress test, and I don't think anyone brought it up, but you got an interesting quandary here. Money market funds paying 4%. Bank rates are paying like 0.0 something, something really minuscule. Banks are going to have to decide if they can compete with money markets. That means they wipe out all of their profits. If banks can't compete with money markets, then, you know, that means there could be a bank run. So they're in a delicate position, but to a degree, aggressive rate hikes by Jay Powell helped put them there.
Let's talk about the inflation data, right? Because Powell kicked everything off by saying our mandate, as a reminder, is to manage inflation and employment, right? Those are the numbers they're focused on. We saw the last number, the CPI number was 6%, and it was, you know, yay, fuel prices are down. Even food prices fell a little bit. But the big highlight was that shelter costs, housing, rent, those were really a big participant in the inflation sort of still being elevated, right, at 6%. So if that's true, that housing costs are the big factor here right now, and that's a lagging indicator, then how much did that factor in to the Fed's decision to raise rates this time? Why did that not contribute to a pause if we're looking at data that lags?
Well, the Fed has made up its own metric now. So and it doesn't include housing. It's core service inflation excluding housing, because Jay Powell said that they see where new leases are down dramatically. But that's the housing situation is only 44% of the core. When you look at PCE, which they look at a little bit more than CPI. And then he said that there's been no progress on non-housing services, which is 56% of it. So the bulk of their key inflation gauge that they use, the, you know, for whatever reason, this is what Powell has focused on. The needle isn't moving. Here's the problem with that, though. And I think it's underappreciated and not talked about enough. We've never been in this situation before as a nation. Never has the government printed trillions and trillions of dollars. And, you know, obviously in the beginning of the pandemic, when people could not go to work, and they didn't know where their paychecks were coming from. Okay, print a bunch of money, keep people whole, because it's the same government that's saying you can't leave your house. But when we came into 2021, with the corporations sitting on the most cash ever, with a household's balance sheets the healthiest that they'd ever been, there was really no need for another $2 trillion, but we got it. And I don't think people truly appreciate how long it takes to get $2 trillion out of the economy. Yeah, you know, you get folks who initially spend a bunch of it, but then the people they spend it with, they use it and then they spend it. It takes a long time. And this is where I have trouble with the Federal Reserve. I don't care how ham-fisted they are, because the money is being transferred to stronger hands. They're punishing people who've already spent their semi-checks. They're punishing people who are living week to week. They're punishing people who are going to lose their jobs as they see unemployment going to 4.6% next year. So they're punishing people who got this money ostensibly to spend it. So they did what they were supposed to do, and now they're paying a very heavy price. And I don't think anything the Fed does is going to harm the folks who now have that money. I think it's got to run its course. And if you remember, when inflation initially became a problem, not only did the Federal Reserve get it wrong, but so many economists, one after another, said the cure for high prices is high prices, that it would work its way out, itself out. And I think to a degree, that's got to happen.
Well, and actually, that's my next question was, we do see prices of other things falling even a bit, right? Even food. Is housing the kind of thing that doesn't fall barring some bigger catastrophe? Like once you pay at that higher price, once you lock in that, you've agreed to that new rent rate or you've agreed to that mortgage, like that's it. You've set a new bar for housing costs.
That's true to a degree. We did, though, have existing homes where year over year, and it was really microscopic, was down like 0.2% median prices. But a few months earlier, the median prices were up 30% year over year. So to go up 30%, the growth of home prices has stopped and stalled, right. which is something that you kind of want to see happen. But the Fed is saying, they're not even looking at that. They're looking at, what people are doing, going on 3-day weekends and what they're spending on services. And, we're a service driven economy. So it's really tough. Also, of course, Jay Powell mentioned labor and how strong the labor market is. But I point out, for instance, this last jobs report, the bulk of that was leisure and hospitality and a lot of retail jobs. Well, the lowest paying jobs in this country are leisure and hospitality. And while it may look great on an overall number, hey, we had 300,000 jobs, the composition of those jobs is down dramatically. And the pay does not add inflation pressure.
Charles, you had a moment on the Big Money Show Wednesday. They played a clip for you of Ken Langone saying everyone on the Fed board should just resign right now. And you then asked, and I loved your response, you then asked, yeah, but who would fill those roles? Anyone better? And it made me sort of have a zoom out moment about how we did get here. Fed intervention over the course of years. Can you, in a final thought, sort of frame this moment for us in time about how we got here and where we should be going?
I sourced the genesis of this to the flash crash or Black Monday, 1987, the biggest single worst session for the stock market, even during the Great Depression. We didn't have a one day down 23%. And then the then new Fed chairman on a job for 1 month, a guy named Alan Greenspan, swung into action. Very aggressive action, very forceful. And became a friend of the stock market. The Fed became what they called accommodative. He earned a moniker, the maestro. Mm-hmm. And I feel like ever since then, the Fed has erred on the side of being friendly to the stock market over everything else. And I think they've now sort of perpetuated this wild swing of the pendulum. And so I think our over-reliance on the Federal Reserve. By the way, if you ever get a chance, pull up a 50-year chart of the stock market or a 100-year chart of the stock market. See how smooth it is until right around 1987, 88. Then it goes nuts. You got these giant moves up and these giant moves down and these giant moves up and these giant moves down. And I just, you just feel like whoever is in charge of the Fed, and no matter what they say, how much they say they ignore the market, at some point, they always come to the rescue.
Sounds like a great book title, Smooth Until 87.
Or a drink, I don't know.
Charles Payne, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.
This is Charlie Hurt with your Fox News commentary coming up.
It's an app a lot of kids love, but a lot of adults fear. TikTok. Especially FBI Director Christopher Wray.
This is a tool that is ultimately within the control of the Chinese government. And it screams out with national security concerns.
TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, is Chinese. And the worry is users' data is at risk and content is being manipulated. TikTok is already banned on U.S. government-issued and many state-issued phones and devices. And Congress is considering giving President Biden more authority to ban TikTok entirely. The president reportedly has told the app to get rid of its Chinese ties or else be outlawed in the U.S. TikTok's CEO posted a message to users on the app.
This could take TikTok away from all 150 million of you.
Shou Zichu will testify today at a House hearing.
To share all that we're doing to protect Americans using the app and deliver on our mission to inspire creativity and to bring joy.
Republican Congresswoman Marionette Miller Meeks will be at the hearing, able to ask him questions, and tells Fox she needs to be convinced.
They have guardrails and blockades for collecting data, collecting keystrokes and passwords, that they're not using surveillance data.
But cybersecurity expert John Cofrancesco says there can be no such reassurance.
This particular app is pernicious because the line of delineation between this app, TikTok, and the Chinese Communist Party is exactly zero.
John Cofrancesco is the founder and CEO of the company Applied AI.
When you're on your TikTok, just understand that your children are sending all of their data right back to the Chinese Communist Party. So that makes this particular app, although there are many like it, quite risky.
Okay. All right. Now, I've read a lot of stories about TikTok. A lot of the stories that I'm reading say that there is all this concern about users' data on TikTok being shared with the Chinese government. And then there's always a line, but there is no evidence that such data has been turned over. My question is, how do they know that?
But so there's already a great deal of evidence to show that a lot of the bots online, a lot of the vitriol you see online is driven from foreign governments, China and Russia in particular. TikTok is a really nasty instance of this because of the nature of the data it collects. So imagine, if you will, you kind of wind back to your 1960s James Bond movies. You'll recall that you could put little microphones. Q would give James a microphone, and you could use that to collect data. Well, what TikTok has done is they've enabled these pixel tools to go into all of your applications, to follow you online, whether that's you're just floating around using your typical email or you're doing anything else, and it collects everything that you're doing, and it sends that back to the parent company at ByteDance. The problem, of course, is that the employees at ByteDance, they wake up in the morning as computer engineers, but they're also members of the Chinese Communist Party. So to say that ByteDance and TikTok by extension doesn't send data back to China is just a ridiculous claim when you hear their company saying that, because the same employees who are engineering the program are also members of an adversarial government.
But supposedly there's this wall, right, that the TikTok data that's collected in the U.S. and maybe stored here or in Singapore gets deleted, doesn't get to China. That's the claim.
It's absolute nonsense, because you don't have to physically move the data to China in order for the Chinese to be spying on the data. But so if you just have a bunch of engineers who are Chinese Communist Party members or by extension working for their intelligence agencies, and they're the ones building the program and they're the ones who have access to the root data, that means the Chinese Communist Party has access to the data. So don't think about it like in the old days where you physically had to move something to a place in order to capture it. The fact of the matter is the engineers for this company are captured. They're individuals who are interested in working against the United States. So there are other examples of this, and I think this is the counterargument you're hearing from China. But the reality is this particular app is risky for us. It's really not a great app for us to have.
Okay, all right. Now, you talked about these pixels, and they track everything. So I don't have TikTok on my phone, but if I did, I wouldn't have to be on the app for the pixels to be tracking what I'm doing on my phone. Right?
Oh, not only do you not have to be on the app, but you could have never have used TikTok. And because some other user has used TikTok and that pixel's been deployed into some other piece of code, right? So some website, there's now a profile for you in the TikTok database, despite the fact you might have never used the system.
Wait a minute. Back up. I don't have the app on my phone, but you're saying that TikTok would already know me?
Absolutely. They absolutely have a profile on you, whether or not you've been on the app. And let's talk about why this technology was invented. I think it's really important to sort of take a step back and understand why, right? So it's not like ordinary people are deploying these spy tools for the purpose of spying. What's really happened is that TikTok and others, Google, have developed these incredibly powerful marketing tools. And what they do is they track you so they can determine what it is that you're willing to buy. And then they sell that data to advertisers so they can get you to buy whatever it is that they're trying to hawk.
Now, hasn't Apple over time allowed you to turn some of those features off, say, on Facebook?
Frankly, Apple has been the leading company of reversing this trend, but it's like anything else. Apple took one step and the programmers developed a way around it. So I would say it has limited, in some use cases, what can be done, but it hasn't stopped at one iota in total.
All right. Should I be concerned about that kind of use of my data for marketing?
Yes. You shouldn't be concerned for marketing in and of itself. You should be concerned on all the other things they can do with that data that has nothing to do with marketing.
But what can I do about it? I mean, if it's so pernicious and in all these apps that people use, not even, you know, owned by China apps, but just apps here in the U.S. that are not owned by a foreign adversary, how am I ever going to get my data back? I mean, it feels like the barn door's open and every animal's gone.
Well, now you sound just like the CEO of TikTok and, frankly, just like the Chinese government, and they're right.
Well, I didn't mean to.
But you're on the mark here. So this legislation, which I favor for the record, but this legislation and what they're talking about doing, banning TikTok, is like covering a gunshot wound with a Band-Aid. The cat's already out of the bag. They've already got us dead to rights. And every application, not just TikTok, now has components of this code. So it's really all around. But there is something that can be done. And frankly, our friends in Europe have taken the lead here. We should pay attention to them. They've been very successful. There's something in Europe called the General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR. And every company whined and moaned about it. They really hated it. Because what it did is it allowed individuals to take control of their privacy back. So in Europe, if you're a European citizen, you can call up any company in the world and you can give them 30 days to delete every piece of data they have on you. And if they refuse or if they fail to meet the deadline, they can get billion-dollar fines. So as you can imagine, right, the behavior in Europe is a lot better, even from American or Chinese companies.
But how am I going to know who has all my data at this point?
What you can do is you can, in the same respect that you can put yourself on the don't call me list, you can do the same thing there. So you can say, hey, don't collect on me list. We need to mirror that here, but we have not yet. That's so as an individual today, you're a U.S. citizen, me, you, our children, really there's nothing you can do. You can limit some of the influence by not using TikTok. You can limit some of the access by changing the controls on your Apple phone. But at a broad level, until we change the laws in this country, it's the Wild West.
The law that may occur that allows President Biden to ban TikTok as an app here in the U.S. I know it's already banned on some state issued devices, some U.S. government issued devices. That law, you say you support it. Do you think that we should ban TikTok? Let me do it in two ways. Should we demand that TikTok and its current ownership get rid of ByteDance altogether, no more Chinese ties whatsoever in order to stay here? Or should we just ban it altogether anyway?
I favor banning it altogether. But to be clear, that's mostly just a show of force. Really, what we need is much broader legislation that affects every company, not just ByteDance. Because let's be clear, the second we turn off TikTok, there will be another application that is also made by the Chinese or that has Chinese code in it that is going to be doing the exact same thing. And there are American companies that have programmers that are in support of the Chinese Communist Party that are doing the same thing. So I support the legislation, regardless of which direction it goes. But again, that's a show of force.
Let me get into the manipulation of content argument that is being used also, that China is able to do that. How does that work?
The first thing to do is to understand the value of the tools, right? So in China, they have a version of TikTok. And if you go to their what they're recommending to their children, they're recommending learn about history, learn economics, learn engineering, right? If you go into the American version of TikTok, what you see is things that encourage children to hurt themselves, things that encourage children to waste their time, things that encourage children to really not like the United States. So they can push through the algorithm things that are very controversial, things that are also really effective at giving children that dopamine hit, very much like a drug. And that's what they do here in the United States. They never do that on their own system at home. The second thing to understand is that they've actually designed the algorithms. And this isn't just TikTok for the record, but they have explicitly designed the algorithms to push vitriol because it's good for business. It allows them to get more looks, more screen time, but it also divides us. So if you have somebody who really says something wild on TikTok, that will move right to the top of the list, particularly if it's something you don't like, because they know that you're going to pay attention to it, which is profit center for them. But they also know it's going to give you this feeling of disassociation from your fellow citizens. And in a democracy, in an open system like we have, really the biggest threat is our disunity. And we've seen that tremendously now for something like the last 8 years. These guys are really pulling our strings, and it is the broad risk that these apps have. And it's something that we really need to get a handle on.
What should a parent tell a child that says, why, like my son's even said, what's the problem with TikTok? Why are they trying to get rid of it?
I think it's a really complicated conversation to have with the child.
Because they love right? They watch all the videos. They have fun with them.
Of course. It's a ton of fun. It hits on that dopamine center. It's the same one that in the 50s, you know, the reason why kids were smoking cigarettes is the same reason kids are watching TikTok today. It is the same chemical effect. It's so very difficult to convince kids not to do that. Here's what I would say, and we don't allow our children, my wife and I, at all on social media. But here's what I would say to your child is that in 3 or 4 or 5 years, nothing that happened on this app will matter to you one iota. But in 3 or 4 or 5 years, you may have done things on this app that will greatly affect the outcome of your life. I need to keep you off of it for your own health and benefit.
John Cofrancesco, cybersecurity expert and the founder and CEO of the company Applied AI. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Meet the American who
designed the Empire State Building.
William F. Lamb was born in Brooklyn in 1883 in an era of monumental architecture in New York City. As a young man, he studied at Williams College in Massachusetts and at Columbia University in Manhattan. He then went to Paris to earn a diploma. He also overcame terrifying adversity, the loss of a leg in a motorcycle accident. It crippled his body, but not his genius. He returned to New York City and became a partner in the firm of Shrev and Lamb, soon to be named Shrev, Lamb, and Harmon in the 1920s. Lamb built his reputation designing many of New York City's early landmark skyscrapers, including the Standard Oil Building and the General Motors Building. He also designed the Reynolds Building for R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, cited by some as a stylistic precursor of the Empire State Building. In 1930, his firm was enlisted to design an ambitious new skyscraper in Manhattan, the Empire State Building. Amazingly, the construction was completed just 18 months later. The building has 10 million bricks, 200,000 cubic feet of Indiana limestone, 6,400 windows, and 37 million cubic feet of space, according to the book, The Empire State Building, The Making of a Landmark, by John Taranik. The Empire State Building stands 102 stories and 1,200 feet tall, 1,450 feet high, with its gleaming antenna, an addition opposed by the architect. The Empire State Building remains among the world's most iconic skyscrapers and one of America's most popular tourist attractions. Its architect, William F. Lamb, died on September 8, 1952. He was 68 years old. I'm Kate Pierce. Go to the lifestyle section at foxnews.com to find more of these incredible American stories.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, The Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts. Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Charlie Hurt.
What's on your mind?
New York Democrats normally invest all of their energies into destroying America's largest city. They have successfully sparked a mass migration of residents to any place that is not run by New York Democrats. Now, New York Democrats have a new mission, getting Donald Trump reelected president. As crime spirals out of control and Wall Street crooks walk away with yet another massive bailout orchestrated by Democrat politicians, Democrat prosecutors in New York are obsessed with the former president. That and drag queen story hour for children. New York Attorney General Letitia James and other Democrats hosted such an event for children over the weekend at the New York City Public Library. Now comes Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, another Democrat, whose open embrace of criminals and the violent crimes they commit has ushered in one of the most dramatic spikes in homicides, robberies, and other lawlessness New York has ever seen. Mr. Bragg is also committed, apparently, to getting Mr. Trump back into the White House. Mr. Trump announced over the weekend that he expects to be arrested by Mr. Bragg later this week on fairly bizarre charges that he paid $130,000 in hush money to porn actress Stormy Daniels during the 2016 election cycle. Hilariously, Mr. Bragg and his crack team of Democrat prosecutors claimed the payment was a violation of federal campaign finance laws. The biggest obstacle for Mr. Trump's reelection efforts, both in 2020 and today, is that as a sitting president or a former president, Mr. Trump loses his most wonderfully effective and appealing persona, that of the marauding barbarian at the gate. Mr. Trump got elected in 2016 because he promised to crash the system from the outside. When Democrat politicians and Republicans screamed like weenies in a campfire about how vulgar and dangerous and unpresidential Mr. Trump was, voters loved him even more. It is a testament to how much the innocent American citizen despises Washington and all the swamp lizards who infest the place. This is why Democrats, many Washington Republicans, the deep state, and the sleazy media all conspired to stop Mr. Trump. They made up lies, they pinned the China virus on him, they changed all the voting rules, and they shredded the First Amendment to protect Mr. Trump's opponents. In short, they stole the 2020 election. Today, Mr. Trump's biggest challenge is reclaiming his outsider status as a destructive marauder, even though he technically served 4 years in the White House. Now, I would argue that he and his supporters were denied his first term because of all the ways Washington set about destroying him even before his first inauguration. Well, the best way to make Mr. Trump resume the mantle of outside marauder charging the gates would be to arrest him on blatantly partisan manufactured political charges. Leading Republican candidate and former president of the United States of America will be arrested on Tuesday, Mr. Trump announced over the weekend. Protest! Take our nation back! If indeed Mr. Trump is arrested, voters will protest at the ballot box next year. Godspeed, Mr. Bragg. Thank you for your service. I'm Charlie Hurt, Washington Times.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at guybensonshow.com.